Welcome to Health Matters, Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, psychologist, licensed counselor, and marriage and family therapist. This evening, we're going to discuss COVID-19 and substance abuse. As our guests, we have Dr. Nicholas Getters, professor and head of pharmacology, toxicology, and neuroscience at LSU Health, and Kent Dean, director of CADA, School of Addiction and Behavioral Health. We invite our listeners to call in with your comments and questions. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. I want to start with you, Dr. Getters. Tell us a little bit about you and what you do at LSU.
Well, I've been here, it'll be 35 years in October. I have spent that time studying drug addiction, primarily cocaine and methamphetamine. But what I like to tell people is I've actually been studying addiction all my life. Both of my parents were alcoholics, and I didn't really realize I was living in a dysfunctional family until I got older. I just thought all the things that went on were normal. And I didn't realize that learning how to make a drink at 8 years old was something that wasn't natural. And so I guess it was just a natural progression for me to end up studying drug addiction for most of my life. Most of my research in the laboratory has been on stress and the effects of stress on addiction, how stress can make people more vulnerable. So it really ties in well with the COVID-19 pandemic and a lot of the things that are going on.
Yeah, definitely a lot of stress going on right now.
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely. And Kent, tell us about you, CADA, and what you do at CADA.
Okay, well, hi, everybody. Hi, Shelley. I'm Dr. Kent Dean, and I've been with CADA now. Actually, I've been with CADA one way or the other for about 35 years and one for guys or another. I just can't seem to shake them in my professional life and wouldn't want to. I'm here full time now as the director of the School of Addiction and Behavioral Health. It's very active. And right now, of course, it's all online. So we're all learning how to do things virtually. But in terms of the pandemic and what we're seeing here, in addition to an initial drop in client frequency, of course, we're seeing people who are basically regressing. I guess we all are to some extent throughout this pandemic. But what we're seeing, as we'll discuss tonight, what we're seeing is people relapsing who had maybe even some degree of time in recovery, but certainly those in early recovery are just in what's the cliche, the perfect storm of circumstances that create just basically a disaster waiting to happen in terms of their recovery. So what we're trying to do at CADA, both not only in terms of education, but in treatment, is to help people weather that without becoming so demoralized, not only by the effects of the pandemic, but by lapses or relapses that they might have, that they drop out of recovery altogether. That's the last thing we want to see them do. So we're kind of literally at the front lines.
Would one or both of you mind talking a little bit about the background, the history of substance abuse treatment, and how it's changed and evolved over the years?
Nick, you want to, or I can, or?
Go ahead, Ken.
Okay. Well, yeah, I've been doing this for about 40 years now, and that's long enough to have seen three or four major paradigm shifts in how addiction is treated. Back when I was interning in grad school the first time around, it was commonplace for so-called substance abuse counselors to be rather militaristic, I guess you could say, and even harsh and kind of boot camp style of treatment, which we have all obviously thoroughly, I hope, repudiated. Two big factors have come into play in the evolution of treatment. One is the recognition that trauma in the life of our patients and clients cannot be overlooked. Back in the old days, say 20, 25 years or more ago, we looked at trauma, but it really wasn't given a very high priority in terms of assessment. It should have been, because what we see is that the vast majority of people who come to see us have some history of trauma in their family, some personal history, which of course with this pandemic is only being exacerbated. Because imagine being stuck at home now in a stay-at-home order with an abuser. So that's a major thing. But the other is, of course, recognition that of how people change and the stages they go through. The so-called stages of change model is a big thing now, and rightly so. And recognizing that people make change in a very specific kinds of ways, and that they do it basically when they see doing so as being in their own best interest. So what we strive to do is help people see the disparity between where they are now and where they would like to be, but to do it in as gentle a way as possible, because I mean, people are frustrated already when they come to see us. They don't need us beating them over the head with anything. So what the main way treatment has changed is it's certainly become more individualized rather than the cookie cutter approach. We moved away from the 12 steps, not repudiating them. It's just that we recognize we have other things we need to be doing with people. So it's by way of a referral rather than primary treatment. So it's this is not your father's treatment, in other words. This is something very different nowadays. And I think, you know, if I live long enough to see another paradigm shift, we're going to look back on this as being probably hopelessly primitive and wondering, you know, how we got away with doing what we're doing now. But until that day comes, you know, we're all doing the best we know how to do. And certainly the rapidity with which people can stabilize has improved, even through the pandemic. And the reliability of treatment is for addiction is much higher than it used to be. What I mean is the prognosis basically is much better than it used to be.
And if I could say something, Shelley, the reason I pass that on to Kent is because, as I said in the introduction, I've spent most of my career, my whole career, studying or doing research in drug addiction. And I'm something that I didn't mention earlier. I'm also the executive director of the Louisiana Addiction Research Center, or LARC, here at LSU Health Shreveport. And LARC is one of the newest research centers on the campus. And as a research center, we don't actually do treatment. We can point people to where they can get treatment, but what we want to do is better educate the public and better educate healthcare professionals about some of the best models of care for treating substance use disorder. We want to also help to develop better models of care. Like Kent was mentioning, what we have now is good, but it could be better, because there are always people that are falling through the cracks. And to take the continuum of care from where someone may be in an abusive environment, and then they get into treatment and they get out of treatment, then what happens to them? How do you keep them from relapsing? And so that is one of the things that the LARC wants to study. The other thing, and this is one of the most important things, at least to me, is to destigmatize addiction. In a lot of cases, people will think about addiction as being, you know, that's that bum on the street, or that's the person committing crimes, or you know, they're looked down on as second class citizens. But that's kind of why I gave the introduction I did. My parents, they were alcoholics, but they were for the most part functioning alcoholics. You couldn't tell, unless they were drunk, you couldn't tell them as being any different from anyone else. And for a lot of people that have problems with substance use disorders, they're not monsters. They're your sister, your brother, your son. They're people like all of the rest of us. We're all people. We're all deserving of love and care. And that's what has to be taken into consideration when we talk about substance use disorder. And that stigma sometimes prevents people from looking for care, that for going in to treatment, because they don't want people to say, oh, look at that addict, he needs treatment or she needs treatment. And that's, these are the things that the LARC was founded to do, to try to change the way society looks at addiction.
So as new substances have become more readily available to people, has that changed the way that treatment is approached, or the way that research is approached, or research findings?
You know, as new drugs are, you know, come on the scene, it seems like, although there may be a new formulation, a new chemical, a new structure, whatever, the addiction process pretty much follows the same line. The person begins using the drug, whether it's alcohol or cigarette smoking or heroin. They start using the drug. Let me back up a step. when someone comes in for treatment, I'm sure Kent can tell you this as well, but the people here at LSU have told me the same thing. People come in for treatment and they're often asked, did you grow up thinking that you wanted to become a heroin addict? Or did you grow up thinking that you wanted to be an alcoholic? And nobody starts out wanting to become, have some sort of substance use disorder. And so regardless of what the chemical is, regardless of its chemical makeup or what have you, the addiction process is pretty much the same thing, that the person is using that substance, whatever it is, in order to cope with what's going on in their lives, either to suppress a traumatic event or to give them courage or to give them energy or for something like that. So I don't think that it's so much that a new drug is coming onto the scene. The addiction pattern is pretty much the same. Do you see that way, Kent?
Yeah, in fact, I'd even take it a little bit further, perhaps, to say not only do people not plan to develop an addictive disorder earlier in life, they develop it in spite of their very best efforts, typically over a lot of years, to keep it from happening or at least getting worse. It's like any other mental illness in that it has a certain intractability to it. And despite their best efforts, they're pulled into this maelstrom of symptoms and problems and all of that that just ricochet off each other. And this is absent any kind of pandemic. And it's well nigh impossible to deal with by yourself.
And we have a caller. We have Randall from Cross Lake. Randall, you can go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I've got a lot of experience in the realm of pain medicine, and as a provider, what I'm seeing pretty commonly with regards to possibly substance use disorder are things like kratom, and I was wondering if maybe Dr. Getters could let us know what the structure of that is, and I know it's available sort of as a supplement type of medication, and if it has any addictive properties.
Well, I don't offhand know the structure for it. I have heard of it. I know people are using it. That's one of those drugs that, for lack of a better word, scares me, because it's something that hasn't been studied in the laboratory or by the medical community to a great extent. So we don't know what all the drug could be doing physiologically, what kind of harm it could be producing. But I know that it's here. I know that there have been cases that have come into the ER and they haven't been able to determine what's wrong with this individual. And then they send the blood off to the crime lab and they test it and it comes back that to have this substance in it. But these newer synthetic type drugs, newer to me anyway, they scare me because, first of all, you don't know what's in it or what it's going to do in the body. Secondly, it may not be what the person who gives it to someone or sells it to them really is. Many of the people that put together these designer drugs or cook them, however they do it, they may not have been the people sitting next to me in chemistry class. And it may be that, you know, it may not be exactly what they think it is. But that is something I've heard of. I don't know the structure. I'm sorry. And even if I did, someone who takes it may not be getting what they think they're getting.
I invite our listeners to call with your question or comment on COVID-19 and substance abuse. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. How prevalent is alcohol and drug addiction, and how has that prevalence changed during the pandemic?
Well, I'm not exactly sure of the exact percentage of the population, but it's certainly a decisive fraction of the population. And during the pandemic, what we have seen already is a surge in use not only of alcohol, but other substances of abuse. And you know, nowadays they call them substance-related and addictive disorders, because now for the first time, gambling disorder is being included. And we're seeing a surge in that. There's a lot of ways to gamble online. And so we're seeing also a surge in that.
What about the way that services are provided, substance abuse services are provided? How has that changed during the pandemic?
Are you asking me, Shelley?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's we do see people face-to-face, and of course we recommend people wear masks, and certainly the staff does, but we're doing a lot of telehealth, a lot of virtual, not only treatment, but assessment and all of that, because we recognize that people can't wait to get help just because, and I don't mean to, I'm not minimizing the effect of the pandemic, but it can't be enough to stop people from getting the help they need. So we're reaching out to them in any kind of electronic and internet-based format that we can, plus the good old telephone. And we also have a crisis outreach team, which goes around, and they are making the rounds some of the state now, beginning to again, to spread the word, but not only about what Cato offers, but also to offer educational materials and Narcan for providers who and members of the public who might be able to benefit from that.
So I read a statistic that during the pandemic that alcohol sales have gone up like 55%.
I saw that, yes. Yes.
Amount. The increase in alcohol use and substance use and even other addictive behaviors like gambling. What are your thoughts on, or both of your thoughts on why this has occurred, why this increase has occurred?
We have some fairly clear answers. Nick, do you want to say something first, or do you want me to go on? Or
you can start, and then I can.
Okay. Well, again, it's the cliche I used earlier certainly applies. It's a perfect storm. We have isolation, we have anxiety, we have depression, we have to people who are staying at home as often as not with somebody who may be abusive, and these things are all situations that plague people with addictive disorders without a pandemic. What the pandemic is doing, of course, with the stay-at-home orders and just this unrelenting barrage of bad, I mean, really bad news that people are getting every day on television and on the internet is just wearing some people down, and they're becoming demoralized. It's exacerbating any kind of pre-existing mental illness, which then, of course, can ricochet against their problem with chemicals. And so those factors of loneliness and isolation and lack of structure, having to impose new structures, you know, staying at home is great. It's kind of like I love you forever, but not for lunch. I mean, there's a point at which it starts to wear on you. And people who are not used to staying home, at least not all day, and certainly not used to working from home, can find this very burdensome. People who don't have jobs because of the pandemic are retreating into use of chemicals, or who've lost their jobs, who are having trouble paying bills, people who are worried about themselves getting a very contagious virus, worried about their loved ones. There's just no end of things that people can fret about, even if they're not prone to fret because of some sort of psychological problem. So you add the availability of a chemical that can make all of that go away just in a few minutes, and it's pretty tempting.
And I'd like to follow up, if I could. When we first started with call it the lockdown, where we had to stay at home, we couldn't come into work, and everyone had to stay at home. I wrote a piece that we put up on the LARC website. I called it the looming crisis in the wake of COVID-19. And even at the beginning, at the onset, I knew that there was going to be a problem, because if you're stuck inside your house and you can't go and see your counselor for treatment, because before we started getting Zoom and other types of virtual calls set up, a person couldn't go in and see his or her counselor. And so that was going to be a problem. They couldn't access the treatment they needed. All of the hospitals stopped seeing anyone that wasn't COVID-related at first. So all non-essential surgeries and non-essential procedures were all put on hold. And, I mean, people weren't even going in for their problems with their heart or to check for cancer or anything else. It was putting huge stresses on them medically as well. And then you take people who, once they finish treatment, although, as Kent said, CADA doesn't follow the 12-step model, a lot of people, when they finish treatment, continue with 12-step programs, whether it's AA or Celebrate Recovery. And these are groups where people can meet regularly every Thursday night or what have you. And they meet and they are able to talk about their problems with their peers. And this, in many cases, helps people to maintain their sobriety. And in these 12-step groups, they have accountability partners and they have sponsors. And all of this kind of falls by the wayside if you're stuck at home. There were studies that were done after 9/11 in New York City, and it was proven in these studies, retrospective studies, that there were increases in alcoholism and cigarette smoking and whatever else they looked at in people during this time. They looked at people in the New Orleans area post-Katrina, and it was shown that there were increases in alcoholism and other substance abuse. Now you take a pandemic that encompasses the entire United States. After 9/11 in New York, you could go to Connecticut or go to another state and get away from it. After Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, you could go to Houston or come up to Shreveport and escape it. The pandemic, there's no escape. When the whole country was locked down, it was locked down and there was nowhere you could go. You couldn't escape this unseen monster because this virus can't be seen. 1 week you would hear something from the FDA and the next week you would hear something else. And it was like questions weren't being answered. And this was just a huge, huge stressor that to me far outshadowed 9/11 or Katrina or any other disaster because it was nation or actually worldwide. And so as we begin to come out of this pandemic, I am almost certain we're going to see this vast numbers of people that resorted to using drugs and other substances, alcohol and other substances, in order to try to cope with the fear and the stress associated with this pandemic.
I'd like to say something about that also. Somebody once said to me, echoing what Nick just said, he said, this pandemic is like Katrina in slow motion. You know, Katrina was, what, several hours, a couple of days, and then the storm itself was over. Now, there was just a ghastly aftermath. I understand that. Same thing with 9/11. But they happened and they were over. This thing is apparently just getting started good. And that also is a source of a lot of stress to people. And looking, something that concerns me, I don't mean to be Debbie Downer, but I know I read, and I don't remember what it was, but I read a book a long time ago that described the state of the United States after the Civil War, when so many people were killed in the combat for so such a large percentage of the population was killed and wounded. It left lasting scars for generations. And I think this, if we don't do something different, and of course we have the benefit of now of hindsight, seeing how things like this have affected society in general in times past. But if we don't do something about it, the very support structures that we're talking about are themselves going to be weakened. So it's all up to us to fight that sense of demoralization and to not give up and to reach out. And one of the things, you know, the 12-step fellowships have always been famous for is just that fellowship. And it's still available online, but maybe I'm just too old. I don't know, but there's something about getting together in a big group of any kind of support group and talking over a cup of coffee or whatever that you can do online. But I'm looking forward to the day when our various kinds of support structures can reinstitute as some sort of real life on-site reality instead of not necessarily just virtual.
And Zoom just doesn't replace a 12-step or Celebrate Recovery type group because, you know, nothing is going to be able, our virtual meetings can't replace a hug or a friendly handshake. Or in a case such as Zoom, if three people want to talk at the same time, it doesn't work. But if you're in a group setting and three people are all saying yeah and cheering you on and congratulating you for making it another month or another year, what have you, it's a big deal. And you can't get that virtually. You can't get the same sort of reinforcement that comes from these group settings.
Well, and one concern I have is treatment providers being able to keep up. I know that I've seen a huge increase in patients contacting my office and making appointments, and a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, and a lot of people that just have put off getting assessments and other things. And so I have the concern, you know, will we all be able to keep up with the demand that I see coming? And I'm resting up and hoping that I can do my part.
Good, because it's easy to forget to take care of ourselves in times like this.
That's true.
I invite our listeners to join our conversation on COVID-19 and substance abuse. Call with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So how do we determine if someone has a problem with substance use disorder?
Well, one thing is to look at if they're, let's say alcohol, for example, are there changes in the amount of alcohol consumed? Maybe someone normally, and I may oversimplify or not, but normally someone may go home at night after work and have a glass or two of wine with dinner or something like that. But then you start noticing their drink, or if it's yourself, that you're drinking more wine. You'll go through a bottle at night or a six pack of beer or something like that. So there's going to be changes in the amount of the drug, whether it's alcohol or some other drug. Another way to determine if you're getting into trouble with your substance use is if your family and friends say, well, Nick, it looks like you had a lot to drink last night and now you're drinking again, you know. So if your family and friends start expressing some sort of concern, you know, that's another red flag. Right now, I think, I speak for myself, I'm having trouble sleeping because of all of the things that are going on in the world. But if you start seeing changes in your sleep habits, sometimes that can be due to your drug use. Alcohol, we always think of it as being something that helps us to go to sleep at night, but it really doesn't. It'll keep you awake. It'll wake you up in the night. And so really, anything that starts to interfere with your normal daily life, which is a misnomer now because so many people aren't leading normal lives at this moment, but anything that changes your normal activities, whether it's a drug, whether it's gambling, whether it's sex or any other type of addiction, this starts to be a problem if it changes or interferes how you can live how you normally live your life.
No, the CDC says, I believe, if you have more than 15 drinks a week, that's a problem. They must not come from my culture, because that's kind of our normal, but it's certainly, that's a lot of booze. I mean, you have to admit. And yeah, the amount and the just a difference from the way the person used to function, just like Nick said, if somebody's changing in fundamental ways, something's going on.
Is there a tipping point that people usually reach that causes them to seek treatment, or is that different for everyone? What usually spurs someone on to seek treatment?
Well, I know AA calls it the moment of truth. And if you look at the 12 steps of AA, the first step kind of delineates that. At some point, people, their denial breaks down and that door slides aside. And if only for a split second, they see how their situation currently is with a clarity that they really didn't invite and really don't like. And then they see the way things are. And what brings that about? A good therapist can help bring that about, but people very often reach that point all on their own because the same kinds of dysfunction keep on happening. And even the person who has a problem lapses perhaps into denial, but at some point they stop being able to push aside the fact that something is different about their whole life and the way things are working. So that moment of truth is what people describe.
Sometimes the tipping point can come from outside too. Someone that gets in trouble on the job, they're late for work all the time, and they are at their boss is telling them, if you're late again, you might lose your job, or maybe they might use the drug on the job and have an accident, or maybe they'll be caught driving while intoxicated and get a DUI or something. So oftentimes the tipping point can come from outside the person due to their changes in behavior. They're getting in trouble with the law or on the job or with their family.
And one other thing I would mention, it's kind of an obvious statement, but there may well come a time that a genuine crisis happens, specifically a kind of a bolt out of the blue, specifically attributable to the trouble with alcohol or drugs that the person's having. It could be a DWI, some other legal infraction, a family blow up, could be all sorts of things, but that gets their attention as well.
Are there specific elements or pieces that go into most substance abuse treatment plans, or does that differ depending on the person and the substance?
Nick, you want to talk about that? Or
I think this is for you.
Well, what we strive for, of course, is that every treatment plan is individualized to the person we're working with, which is, as I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, that's one way that treatment is changing, is that we are much more successful nowadays, given a widening range of interventions that are available and technical skill on the part of the counselor that's possible. Nonetheless, what we look for as a general rule, obviously we do a diagnostic interview to see if what symptoms the person has, whether they have enough to qualify. In that light, I was one of the people who was privileged to work on DSM-5, and one of the things that we tried to make clear to the work groups that all our data went to was the fact that craving had never been listed, craving for a chemical, had never been listed before as one of the criteria, part of the criteria set, and it now is. Perhaps it wasn't statistically significant enough in times past. I don't know why that was, but now for the first time as of 2013, it is part of the diagnosis, diagnostic criteria. But if somebody, we do an interview to see what are the criteria people meet. We look for psychosocial disruption. We look for physical problems. We look for family problems, emotional problems, just any kind of psychosocial difficulty the person can have. We also, of course, look for severity, because that has to do with the patient placement, what they used to call patient placement criteria from ASAM, the American Society of Addiction Medicine. We need to know, we have so many different kinds of modalities available nowadays, and we do too at CADA. We need to know which is the best modality for this person at this time. So we do a review of that as well.
I invite our listeners to join our conversation on COVID-19 and substance abuse. Call with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. Which treatment types are most supported by research? What do we find as far as the data and treatment? What's most effective?
Well, it depends on the patient. It depends on where they are, the level of deterioration. I'm one of those who really misses, in the older DSM, they had something called the multi-axial evaluation system, and it had something called a global assessment of functioning, which was a scale from 0 to 100. And at 0, I guess you're dead, and 100 is, you're qualifying for sainthood. And your level, general level of functioning was somewhere in between, right? Typically, the lower the GAF, the global assessment of functioning, the more restrictive, more structured, I should say, kind of treatment was appropriate, such as residential or inpatient. But somebody may well nowadays be functioning at a level that is, in a sense, too good for that, and they'll do better in outpatient. What we do know is, and they've all been clinically validated, all the modalities have, but it's very clearly a matter of getting the right patient for the right modality. That having been said, if somebody is in a particular modality, say outpatient or intensive outpatient, and maybe is deteriorating to the point where it looks as though residential treatment might be appropriate, we can move them to that modality. So the idea is that it's kind of a seamless integration of all of these different modalities is another new thing in treatment. It's not one size fits all, of course. And we understand that somebody's circumstances may have changed, for example, with this pandemic. So somebody's circumstances may have changed where we may have been seeing them, say, outpatient in our office, and all of a sudden they're not doing well enough that really that's not enough for them anymore. But at least for the time being, they need to either go into, say, an intensive outpatient or a day hospital or even inpatient or residential for a while, and then to get stabilized, and then they can come back to us.
Is there a particular length of time that's most effective, or is that, again, going to vary depending on the patient?
It's going to vary, but I can give you a pretty good rule of thumb, and I've never met anybody for whom this is not true. The longer, the better. If you have a chronic disease, it needs chronic treatment.
And this would be a good point for me to bring up something. I've talked about studying stress and how it affects addiction, and I've been doing this a long time. And oftentimes we think about stress as being something psychological. It makes us afraid. It makes us mad. Whatever it does, we think of it psychologically. But stress is really a biological, a physiological phenomenon. You've all heard of the fight or flight response, where you might be driving down the road and someone cuts you off, and you have to slam on your brakes, and you may have some words for that person in the other car, but your heart starts beating faster, your pupils dilate in your eyes, your breathing changes. It's a physiological response. That's what you feel outside of the brain, but there's a biological, physiological response going on inside the brain itself. And some of the studies that we've done here at LSU have shown that the effects of stress are changing some of the same parts of the brain that are affected by different drugs, different substances that are used by humans. And this suggests that repeated exposure to stress can alter the brain in such a way where it makes someone more sensitive, whether it's to alcohol or to heroin or methamphetamine, whatever drug they might choose. And I'm not saying they're predisposed, but their brains have been changed by this chronic exposure to stress that that the drugs help to are make them feel better. And what Kent was talking about just a minute ago about the longer the treatment, the better. What we have to understand is that whether it's alcohol or whatever drug it might be, it's producing a physical change in the brain as well. And so when a person stops drinking, or they stop using heroin, or they stop using Valium, or whatever the drug may be, it's going to take a while also for the brain, the biology of the brain, to start getting back to normal. It doesn't just immediately pop back and become what it was before. It takes a period of time for the brain to get back to the way it was. And I don't just mean like a structure or something, but all of the chemicals that the brain uses to communicate between the different cells and the hormones and everything else that is part of this central nervous system, it's going to take time for things to get back to normal. And so, as I was saying, we think of stress as being this psychological phenomenon, which it is, but it's also producing physiological changes. And we've shown this in the laboratory, and we've shown how these changes occur in the same parts of in the reward pathways in the brain. Think about it, that there are people who are that we call thrill seekers, that they love to jump out of airplanes with parachutes or what have you, that thrill, that adrenaline rush, that's what they seek after. Well, that adrenaline rush happens after the use of a lot of different drugs. So it may be that the person is seeking out this thrill, this rush that takes them away from what's going on in their normal everyday life. And, you know, all of us are thrill seekers to one extent or another. We don't all jump out of airplanes, but there are things that we do because we find them enjoyable. Anything that we find enjoyable is going to activate that same system that is activated by the fight or flight response. And I know that was probably very circular, but what I wanted to stress was that stress.
Nick, we're old. We get to be circular. It's okay.
I hope so. But the point I wanted to make is that this someone who's using a drug, who has a problem with alcohol, who has a problem with whatever it is, they're not a bad person. That it's not just, well, if he was a stronger man, he could stop drinking, or if she was stronger, she could stop using Valium. That has nothing. It's not a matter of being strong or weak. A biological effect has happened in that person, and it takes a while for the biology and the psychology to get back to normal.
No, I think that's a very good point that a lot of people don't understand about addiction, is that it's not just changing the behavior. Yes, we need to change the behaviors, but we also need to give the body time, the brain time to catch up with the behavioral change. And these substances, and then also activities like gambling and pornography addiction and things like that, you know, it's not just quitting the behavior. It's also giving the brain time to recover from the sort of damage that has been done.
Exactly. That's right.
I mentioned something. One of the aspects of contemporary treatment also in many places now is a growing involvement in skills training, not only in practical ways to, say, stay sober or straight or whatever, but also in specific games or exercises, whatever you want to call them, that help the brain to, in a sense, I guess, rewire it. It's kind of the corollary to what Nick was talking about. We recognize that the person who comes to see us from the standpoint of their brain is not the same person that they were, you know, years ago. And I'm assuming from what we know about adolescent development and how protracted it actually can be, that the sooner in life this kind of disruption happens, the more catastrophic. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Yes, I would. And that's why there's such a focus, especially, or more of a focus these days, on childhood trauma. Because things that happen, whether it's physical, sexual, what type of abuse happens, when it happens to someone when they're very young, it can have effects that last into adulthood and can often lead either to different types of mental illness or to substance use disorder.
I invite our listeners to join our conversation on COVID-19 and substance abuse. Call with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. I'd like to talk a little bit about dual diagnosis, the other mental health issues that tend to accompany substance use and addiction.
Who wants to go first?
You go ahead.
Okay. Well, the axiom, I guess, is that we pretty much see some sort of co-occurring disorder or comorbidity in pretty much everybody who comes to see us for a problem with chemicals or some sort of addictive behavior. The most common are the usual suspects, mood disorders, major depressive disorder, bipolar disorders of one description or another, anxiety disorders, and post-traumatic stress disorder, which, you know, that used to be classed with anxiety disorders, but now has its own rubric. Wherever it is in the book, we see a lot of that, and it makes sense because the effects on a human being from trauma don't just go away by themselves. Particularly, I mean, I think that post 9/11 study, the comorbidity study, was really interesting to me because it showed that roughly a third of people, if I recall this right, a third of the people who went through that crisis, if they had a good, strong support system, didn't necessarily need any kind of ongoing therapeutic intervention. Now, but that was 20 years ago. I mean, but now we do know, though, that people who have a strong support system or who can become engaged in one have a much better prognosis than those who don't.
So speaking of support systems, what about family therapy? Is that an important part of a treatment plan?
Absolutely. Most counselors that I'm aware of, me included, would say that if somehow the family system that the person came from is not addressed in some sort of therapeutic way, then And it may not be possible to do that, but if it isn't done, then maybe the whole job didn't get done. People can make a lot of progress without it, but part of the damage came from the family system for many, many of these people. So it needs to be looked at, because even before the pandemic, if there are self-defeating or abusive patterns going on, then people are going to continue that's going to continue to reverberate through the lives of the people who come to see us, and it's just going to get worse. And so the family needs, they need moral support, and they need guidance and education and counseling to help them move away from these old destructive patterns. It's not always possible, but certainly something we strive for.
So with the pandemic, we have a whole new set of barriers, but what are some of the, I guess, more traditional barriers to getting the treatment that people need?
Well, certainly, you know, I don't want to throw the word denial around, but it really does have a specific utility. I've used the analogy of somebody growing up in a fun house where you have distorted mirrors. And that's all the person has ever seen, is these mirrors that distort the image. So when they leave the funhouse and go out into the real world and look into a normal mirror, that's the one that looks distorted to them. You know, the old saying, what's normal is what you're used to. So people have grown up in such distorted family situations that they don't realize at first that there's something wrong. I have done so many interviews, and I'm sure every counselor has, with people who list just hair-raisingly traumatic events that have happened to them, and make me in the back of my mind think, or maybe the front of my mind think, how the world did they ever make it to my office? I mean, it's amazing that they survived all of this. And they say it without batting an eye. I mean, it's just, it's been so much a part of their life for so long that either they've become inured to it and they really don't see it, or they've developed enough of a defense against it that they're really able to kind of compartmentalize it, which can do its own damage, of course. But so denial is a part of it. Stigma is still a part of it. There is still a sizable proportion of the population of certainly this country that disagrees with much of what we've said here today about, you know, not only the causative factors, but moral aspects of the disease and that kind of thing. They would hold it to be a moral weakness, something that people just need to get up by their bootstraps and get over. That's not gone away. Has it gotten better? I like to think so, but sometimes I wonder. But it's still there. And of course, the other is, you know, those old family secrets, where a family is truly dysfunctional. Very often, if you look at their home from the outside, you're witnessing what you're seeing is a crime scene. You can't see the crime being perpetrated, but that's what you're looking at. And people are all too aware very often, especially the perpetrators, that if this is brought out into the open, you know, I can go to jail. So very often there are explicit threats made. You know, you're going to keep this to yourself. Don't talk about it. Keep it to yourself, because if you mention this to anybody, they're going to take me away from you, and I won't be able to take care of you, and you'll be out on the street. You know, it just goes on and on and on. So they're direct threats from the perpetrators. And something they used to, we call it the trauma bond, they used to call it the Stockholm syndrome, where people who have been perpetrated and abused, their sense of self, I guess, gets shattered to the point where they actually become grateful to the perpetrator in periods when the perpetration is not happening. And that being the case, they don't want something to happen to the perpetrator. You know, the Stockholm syndrome was some robbers came in to a bank in Stockholm, Sweden, and held people hostage for 2 or 3 days. And when they were finally arrested, the former hostages came to the trial, spoke on the behalf of the people who had pointed guns to them and threatened to kill them. And I think one of them even wanted to marry one of the perpetrators. But it just a complete reversal of any kind of self-image of a competent human being. And what I'm saying, this is, if nothing else, the disease of addiction can be a perpetrator in the sense they can just, you know, beat the heck out of somebody. And not only the disease itself, but other human perpetrators can demoralize someone to the point where they really just don't have the wherewithal on their own, right when they come to see us, to say, stop, this is not going to happen anymore. This is not right. I want something to change. They're just not in the ability to be able to do that. So very often, there's some sort of precipitating crisis that gets them into help. But that being said, if that doesn't happen, then very often people are stuck in this, and it's a secret. It's quiet. Nobody knows about it. And so that's one of the barriers that we're up against, is the secrecy that abusive or so-called dysfunctional families very deliberately keep going.
There can be a couple of other barriers, too, that I'd like to mention. One is that not everybody knows where to turn. And I know different treatment centers do have advertising, but they don't always reach everyone. So a lot of times people don't know where to turn. And if you start thinking about people that are in more rural areas, that live, you know, they don't live in Shreveport, they don't live in Baton Rouge or New Orleans, they live in a more rural area, and they don't know where to go, they don't know where to get help. They may go to their physician may not know either. There's not a whole lot of addiction training in medical school. If someone does go on in psychiatry, they may get more information on addiction treatment. But for the most part, most physicians don't get a lot of that. So if you're a physician in a very small town and someone comes to you and they say, you know, I'm having trouble with this drug or that drug, they may not know where to refer them. So that is also a barrier. And that's one of the things that LARC is planning to do, to try to get the word out to rural physicians to better educate them and to help them know where to refer their patients, where to send their patients. One of the things that we hope to get started here, and it's something that we're trying to get funding for, is telemedicine and being able to link with physicians, with the rural physicians, in order to, if they have someone who comes in and has a substance use disorder, they can call us up and we can help them figure out what their particular person may need. I think that even though there are a lot of providers for addiction or substance use disorder, there's not enough. More money needs to go into treatment than into other areas. I'll leave it at that.
So Dr. Getters, I'm gonna give you the last question. We've got about 5 more minutes. I'd like to ask you about a new medication that you helped to develop for addiction.
Okay, well, this is something that is still undergoing clinical trials. The company that I co-founded with some local investors. It's called Embera Neurotherapeutics. And the drug we developed was based on the work I've been doing in the laboratory, as I said, for about 35 years. We did a small trial here a few years ago in the Psychopharmacology Research Unit. It was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study in cocaine users, and we saw a statistically significant reduction in cocaine use, even though the study wasn't, as they call it, powered to show statistical significance, meaning we only enrolled a few people in each arm. But even though we did, we still showed a significant reduction. The compound has gone through phase one clinical trials. It's passed all the FDA hurdles, and it was ready to go into phase two when COVID hit. The last I heard from the company was that they were hoping to be able to, because they're looking at sites across the country, and in some states that have been able to relax some of the restrictions, they were hoping to get the phase two studies underway by the end of June. And so I'm hopeful that they'll be able to show results in these phase two clinical trials. But it's exciting to me because what this compound we developed, what it does is it short circuits the ability of triggers in the environment. So when someone is using a drug, they commonly will use it in the same place. Let's say the alcoholic that goes to the corner bar and that's where they drink every day. Well, if they go into treatment at CADA and they get clean and they've been sober for a while, and then they happen to walk past that bar, it kind of triggers memories of what it was like to drink, what they felt when they were there. And it's also activating what I talked about earlier, that stress system. And what this compound we developed does is it short circuits the ability of those triggers to activate this stress system in the brain, not the complete body response, but the response in the brain. And it limits the ability of those triggers to stimulate craving that leads to relapse. And so I am very confident that it's going to work because it's based on so much empirical evidence in the lab, and we just need to now show it in these phase two and then phase three clinical trials. It's
that's a new, very promising.
I'm sorry.
I'm just impressed
with on my end.
Yeah, I can't hear anything.
Oh, I think we're back.
Okay.
I wasn't sorry, able to hear what you said, but what I did want to say in the last part about this drug with Embera, it's a new way to treat addiction. Instead of looking at a particular drug and the effect of that particular drug, it's looking at the triggers that stimulate craving that lead to relapse, and it's working through that stress system that I was talking about earlier. And that's why I feel that stress can be such a huge impetus for addiction.
Well, I want to thank our guests. Thank you so much, Dr. Kent Dean with CADA, and also Dr. Nicholas Getters. We really appreciate you being with us this evening and sharing your knowledge and all the great information on COVID-19 and substance abuse. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the ability to be able to be with you tonight.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all mental health questions, consult a mental health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Mental Health Matters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derlich and Kermit Poling. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening.